the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129 presents Just Love, a conversation on the Church's social mission with Monsignor Kevin Sullivan.
Welcome to Just Love. Just love God, just love your neighbor, just love yourself, and our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation in which we kind of reflect on what's going on in the world from the perspective of our Catholic values, our Catholic beliefs, and one of the things we believe that our world should be more just and it should be more compassionate. And so this week we're going to do a couple of things. I'm delighted that our first guest, just in a few minutes, is Tom DiNapoli, the 54th controller of the state of New York. And we'll discuss with him kind of public service and some of the issues that he's working on right now to kind of make at least the New York part of the universe a better and a more just place. So we'll speak with Tom in just a few minutes. And then a little bit later on in the show, we're going to speak with a professor, Robert Call from Princeton University. And he's an expert on what's going on in Columbia, not his fellow Ivy League university, but the place in South America where they just had this vote to not end the decades-old confrontation between the drug lords and the government there, and I'm fascinated by that situation. So we're going to speak with Professor Robert Call about that. And then in the middle of the show, I'm going to speak with somebody from CRS, because I just couldn't let this week go past without at least having some conversation about the devastation that a natural disaster is bringing to Haiti. And Catholic Relief Services is always right there when it happens. So I'm just going to have a short conversation with somebody from Catholic Relief Services to talk a little bit about Haiti and what's going on in that devastated country once again, because this time of Hurricane Matthew. So let's go right to our first guest, Controller Thomas DiNapoli, 54th Controller of the State of New York. Tom, thank you so much for being with us.
Monsignor Sullivan, it is great to be back with you as well.
Wonderful. Hey, in terms of full disclosure, I've known Tom for years, and I am biased because I think he is just a great public servant, and I'm proud to call him a friend. And hey, Tom, I got to tell you something. I was up in Westchester this morning. I was meeting with, you know, one of the very, very fine people associated with Catholic Charities, a donor from up there. And I said, you know, I got to leave because I have to do my radio show. And I'm having a controller, Tom DiNapoli, on the show. And this person said to me without any provocation, I'm like, hey, you know, I hear he's not a bad guy. He's pretty good.
Well, I hope you didn't dissuade him of that notion.
Well, I didn't. I didn't because, and actually I can, you know, I'll say that the prior part of our conversation was unfortunately dealing with some of the very, very kind of negativity in the current political climate, and a couple of other names came up that didn't get quite the approval rating that yours did in that conversation. Well, so
that's nice to hear, and I'm going to say the answer, Kevin. I value our friendship and your inspiration. You know, most recently when you participated in the Mass at Labor Day at St. Patrick's, and you know, gave a wonderful homily reminding us all the importance of our faith connected to social justice and being connected to the big issues of the day. Not that everybody necessarily agrees on all those big issues, but that it is important that we keep in mind a broader context. And you have always been most effective in reminding us of how relevant the mission of the church is to daily life and to the problems that we're all going through these days. And I appreciate that, and I draw strength from the ways in which you, with how you model your life and the kind of work you do with Catholic Charities and just being involved in so many good causes. That is a source of a reminder to me just how important the church is, what a very positive role the church plays in communities, and you know, sometimes without getting the full recognition for the difference that that individuals like you really dedicated your life to making a positive difference, that the church has been a vehicle to effectively do that, sometimes more effectively than those of us in public office are able to achieve those same kind of outcomes. So I draw inspiration from you.
Well, Tom, thank you for that. We'll end the interview right there. I want to end on a high note. But Tom, I appreciate that. You know, we try. We don't always succeed. But, you know, again, from the other point of view, what I do want to kind of give you an opportunity to talk about, because let's be fair, you know, this is a very, in my judgment, I'm not putting words in your mouth, my judgment, I don't like this current political climate. I don't like this atmosphere. I don't like when the first comment is about, well, how did it spin? How did it go? As opposed to the substance of, are the policies that are being talked about actually going to help people and things of that nature? My own opinion, you know, rightly, I think there's a lot of frustration. There's a lot of negativity to that. But so I want to, you know, give you a chance because you've been at this public service part for a while. And how do you kind of see it as a way to kind of, and I'm going to use a word, give back, how to make the world a better place? How do you kind of view this over all these years?
Well, you know, it's a question I ask myself a lot lately because I would agree with you, the environment right now is not as conducive to the kind of thoughtful deliberation on big issues that, you know, our we would like to think our democracy is founded on. But, you know, I came of age, you know, at a time where there certainly were big issues and big challenges as there are today, and a lot of rawness in society and divisions, the late 60s, early 70s. But, you know, for me, I found voices like what Martin Luther King was saying, what the Kennedy brothers were saying, John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, were very powerful inspirations for me to wanting to see being involved in politics and government as a calling. And I will say that. I mean, I've been fortunate. I didn't spend all of my working career in government. I spent 10 years in the private sector. But when I had the chance to run for office and get elected, and I've been doing it now, you know, on the state level since 1987, you know, it really is more a vocation than just a career for me, because I do think government at its finest is the place where in this country citizens can be engaged, can give input, and we can come up with solutions to problems, even to tough problems. And, you know, the challenge today, Kevin, is that, you know, everything is just what you said. It's spin, it's, you know, it's moment-to-moment analysis, it's the 24-hour news cycle. Nobody reads the newspaper anymore because you're all looking online real quick. It's, you know, it's Twitter and Facebook and social media. And you know, it's the reality of the world. I'm not, you know, necessarily being critical. It is what it is. But it lends itself to a lot of short-termism in terms of thinking and analysis. And then this crossover from, you know, a sense of politics being reality TV or entertainment rather than, you know, a place for an exchange of ideas. I mean, I think it really has just put a whole different spin on, you know, certainly the presidential race this year in a way that I think turns people off. I hope that at the end of it, people will not stay home. They will come out and vote. As Pope Francis said the other day, Americans should vote their conscience. Look at the issues and the candidates. But, you know, even if you're not happy with the choices, you still got to go out and vote. You got to make a choice. And I do hope that, you know, you saw earlier in this year a lot of young people got involved for the first time. I hope we don't lose them because our country needs healing. The world needs healing. And it will only get better if we all have a seat at the table. And, you know, the kind of cynicism that's out there now, some of it justified, I just worry we'll have people pull away rather than get more involved.
Well, you know, Tom, I think that's very good advice. And as you know, the church has very clear ideas on what public policies will foster the common good, which make our world more just and more compassionate. But we don't tell people how to vote. And that's what the bishops of the country have said. We're not telling you how to vote. Here are some values, principles we want you to bring to the table and evaluate. The one thing we do say, however, is that there is an obligation to participate and there is an obligation to vote. And so, you know, it's not an obligation to, there is not really the option to just sit back as a Catholic and say, well, I'm so fed up, it's somebody else's problem. And so I think your advice is right on target that we need to do that. And again, I don't think we should be overly upset that while the kind of the formal understanding of the church is that we shouldn't support individual candidates, et cetera, you know, every now and then there is a bishop here and there. There is somebody who says, you know, you can't be Catholic if you vote this way because of X, Y, and Z. Those things happen. We're a big church.
But
we got to understand, we got to get out there and vote, and we got to participate. And so,
I think that the ways in which the church raises important issues happens to be key. I also think that, you know, there are opportunities that the church has exercised in the past to try to get to some of that question of how do you get more people to participate. You know, I recently looked at, again, a beautiful essay that was written back in 1999, a long time ago, I think, by the Wisconsin Catholic Conference that was titled Renewing Participation in Public Life, you know, which is really the spirit of what I think our conversation has been about. But it got very specific to the issue of campaign finance reform and really, you know, talking about the need for there to be fundamental changes to make it easier, you know, for citizens at a very grassroots level to feel empowered and to be empowered and really to try to deal with the, you know, the corrosive impact of money in our system. I mean, and this goes back to 1999. It's a few popes ago. It's a while ago.
Yeah.
But, so I think sometimes, you know, people should recognize the church has had, you know, some very thoughtful positions on the structure of political discourse and has not been afraid to say, you know, we need to get back to a fundamental notion of how citizens can be more empowered to be participating in the political process. So, you know, to your listeners, you know, if they want to do a little bit of research, look for this essay from the Wisconsin Catholic Conference, Renewing Participation in Public Life. The words there are as timely in 2016 as they were back in 1999.
We're speaking with Controller Tom DiNapoli, the 54th Controller of the State of New York, and we're kind of speaking about the state of politics in here and about how there is the obligation to get involved, even when we maybe don't like some of the conversation going on, but that we have an obligation to participate and to raise our voices. And Tom, you know, to your point, I think, let me just point out to our listeners, you know, if you go back, you know, over 100 years, I think, you know, if I would kind of raise up maybe three or four issues in which the church and religious organization, not merely the Catholic Church, has been really helpful in advancing what was going on. Clearly, one of the first maybe was the labor movement, the rights of labor to organize. I think that's one issue in which the church made a very positive contribution. The second is the church was very involved in some of the New Deal legislation up to the point of, you know, including Social Security, which has, you know, been responsible for raising out of poverty so many seniors. So I think that was another big issue, a big area that the church was involved in. And obviously, the churches were involved in the civil rights movement, which was a critically important, you know, important issue. And so I do think, you know, I'm hopeful that there are some broad issues. And quite frankly, if you asked me, if I could only pick one of those non-sexy issues that we should get behind and change and do something about, it would be, and I've said it before on the show, campaign finance reform. I mean, you know, and I may be a little bit in politic in saying, you know, enough of this dialing for dollars, meeting for dollars, dinners for dollars, all of that stuff. It just, I think that just has raised up the cynicism that a lot of people have about the political system.
Well, it also makes for a lot of inefficiency. I could tell you, someone, you know, who's been in office, and you know, when you're running statewide, you talk about a lot of dollars, right?
Right.
you know, the amount of time that you have to spend at those dinners, doing those phone calls, it really is a huge distraction. And unless you're going to leave the system to the very wealthy, you know, personally very wealthy, or to those who just have such family or historical connections in politics that they can, you know, they don't have to do a lot of those calls. They get the money, you know, thrown at them, and you know, there are some, you know, instances of that. You know, you really are going to preclude everyday people from running for office, whether that's at the local level, you know, a council seat in the city, or, you know, village office in the suburbs, or, you know, certainly to the higher offices. So you need the kind of changes that will diminish the role that private money plays. I mean, I personally think ultimately, you know, the only solution, because there is an expense with campaigns, you know, gets back to, you know, some kind of public financing mechanism. We could argue what the correct reforms are, but, you know, there's no doubt that we need to deal with the money issue. There's no doubt that we need to make it easier for people. So for a New York context, you know, New York has, you know, certain laws and deadlines and hurdles you have to go through in terms of when you register and if you want to change parties, you know, there are many more requirements in New York than there are in other states. And, you know, the worst thing is when someone shows up to the polls and they want to vote, and then they find out, well, they missed the deadline to register, or, you know, sometimes happened this year in the primaries, well, you know, I'm in X party. And then, well, no, you're not. No, I'm in that, you know. But we have a system that, because unfortunately people sometimes are participating every year, and when they are moved in a year like a presidential year, that where they want to come and play a role, then they find they're closed out because they missed a certain deadline. So we also have to make the kind of changes that will encourage people to be, you know, to be at the table and not have people feel closed out. And I mean, again, that's where, you know, when I turned 18, it was the first year 18-year-olds could vote. You know, but a lot of folks don't remember.
Yeah, but it was. But you didn't have to run for office when you were 18, right?
Well, I had the calling.
Okay.
I always say I took my civic classes a little too seriously, but
you know
what I did.
I'm not being ageist at all, but I will tell you, one of the things that does disturb me, and you know, being in the neighborhood of the ages of the current presidential candidates, it does bother me that. Yeah. That we don't have solid candidates, and I can say it, in, you know, in their 50s or so, who are really kind of full of energy and stuff like that, and we almost seem to be discouraging good candidates in from raising up because of so many things. But Tom, what I don't want to do is I don't want to fall into the trap that we've been talking about, where it's all about spin, it's all about doctors.
Yep.
I want to let you talk about a couple of the issues that, as a public servant, you're using your kind of under-the-radar office. I would say probably the office's controller is one of those that is not high on people's you know, radar screen, but yet critically important. I often talk to you as, by, you're the richest guy in New York State. I mean, you even make all the political candidates. So tell us a little bit about what you've been trying to do as custodian of our pensions, or the public pensions in New York State, on the issue of climate change. Why don't you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah. Happy to do it. And one of the pluses, I think, of this office is, in fact, we don't get caught up in the usual trench warfare of, you know, day-to-day politics, and we can be a little more long-term in view. One of our big responsibilities, as you point out, is serving as trustee of the New York Common Retirement Fund, which provides the retirement benefits for over a million New Yorkers, some retired now and some public employees who, you know, hope to retire down the road. So it's a big responsibility. Well, we're an investor. We keep the fund well-funded by the success of our investments. But when we invest in a company, and a lot of our investments are in public equities, stock in companies that we're all familiar with, we also we need to make money, but we want to make sure the corporations we're investing in are good corporate citizens. So climate change is a huge issue right now, and I had the privilege to be invited to be on one of the panels at the Paris climate talks that came up with that historic agreement back in the fall. And part of why I was invited to be there was as an investor, a pension fund trustee, because we came up with a strategy that we hope others will follow. Some have started to already, where we've set up a very unique index. It's called a low emission index, where we weight our investments in companies based on how they're dealing with the issue of what is their carbon footprint, or what are they doing to disclose their greenhouse gas emissions, what are they doing to reduce those emissions so they can be part of the solution to this issue of risk associated with climate change. What's great about it is when we move $2 billion with a B dollars to seed this index, we look to be adding more money over time, and by moving our investments around based on reward to companies that are doing the right thing and taking money away from companies doing the wrong thing. I think it's a very thoughtful response. You know, some people talk about divestment, take all your money out of some of these companies, but the reality is, you know, you're not going to put, you know, some of these big oil companies out of business because, you know, you take your money out, they're still going to have other investors. So we want to try to incentivize it. And I appreciate here, you know, Pope Francis, especially after Paris, really, you know, said, challenged the world community. So this is an issue. And here you have this historic opportunity where virtually all the nations on the globe have committed to dealing with the issue. How do you translate that into action? And some of it is going to be regulatory and legal steps that governments will take. But investors, moving markets is going to be a key part of it as well. Consumers need to make better choices about products they buy and companies they support. Investors need to say to the marketplace, you know, we're making a transition now to a lower carbon economy. We need to do that to secure this planet and for the health and well-being of all the living creatures on this planet. But how can we do it not in a 30-second soundbite way, but in a thoughtful way? And so I think the approach we've taken in terms of this index is one way. Engaging companies as well. And we did this with the big players, ExxonMobil. We lost a vote there, but we've got 38% on our first shot to file a shareholder resolution saying, how are you adjusting your business model to the reality of climate change? How is that risking the value of our long-term investment in your company if you're not dealing with this? So engaging companies, you know, in terms of being an investor as a shareholder and writing and filing shareholder resolutions, moving our money to certain places in the marketplace. This is how I think New York has appropriately gained a reputation for being in the forefront of being a responsible investor in terms of dealing with the climate change issue.
And now, Tom, I know that whenever we do this stuff, everybody always wants to kind of say, gee, it's good that the other guy is doing it. But when it comes a little bit closer to home, we say, well, maybe we can kind of pass on that one. So listen, I'm not sure. You did a shareholder resolution that you wanted Domino's Pizza to use palm oil, okay? Now, I just want to know, is that going to ruin the taste of my pizza?
Never, never. Well, the key thing is sustainable palm oil, right? So the point is,
I just want it to be sustainable, good-tasting pizza.
Well, no, we're not opposed to good taste. We just don't want to see the rainforest to be destroyed as part of making your pizza taste good. So we've gotten agreements with a number of companies to say we're still going to use the product, but we're going to do it in a way that we're going to make sure that the forest will be renewed and not just cut down. So there's a way to get that taste and still do the right thing.
All right. That's okay, good. Because, you know, I'm not sure I was going to be the biggest fan of the rainforest if it was going to hurt my pizza day. But, you know, but Tom, you know, I think what you're talking about here is going back to our previous conversation. You know, some of the sophisticated approach that you're taking to this is really making our world a better place. But I guarantee you couldn't turn that into a soundbite that would attract votes.
No.
And that's what the tragedy is. So I'm just so glad that we have people like you who a little bit under the radar screen in some of that. Although I might point out to our listeners, you got more votes last time you ran for office than anybody else in New York State. So a little bit above the radar screen in terms of people appreciating the work that you are doing. Hey, Tom, I've kept you long enough, but is there one final thing you'd like to say before I let you go back to investing the money well for us?
Well, first of all, I hope you invite me back soon because it's been
great.
A while since we've done the show. And you know, be involved, be engaged this year. There's a lot at stake, number one. Number two, go to our website, just whatever your search engine is, put in New York State Controller, and look at look at the pension fund part of the website, and you really see how, whether it's on climate change that we talked about, non-discrimination, worker rights in this country and around the globe. You and I talked before about our trip to Bangladesh, right, and the factory workers there. You know, still being engaged with companies to make sure they do the right thing. I want New Yorkers to know that we're doing what we can to make money in an appropriate way for the pension fund, for retirees to help the taxpayers with their burden, but do it in a way that does some good things. And what you said is right. We do it maybe a little bit under the radar, but we're doing it slow and steady, doing it in concert with other responsible players that are out there. And I'm always the optimist. I stay involved with public service because I do believe that we are moving forward. And even if not every battle is won or not every year is as inspiring as you'd like it to be, we are headed in the right direction. We just have to stay positive, draw on our opportunities, you know, where it's our faith and our core beliefs keep us moving, and work together. Government can't do it all, but working with the faith community, working with nonprofits, working with business and labor, government can be a key part of moving us to a better place, be a more inclusive and caring society.
Hey, thanks a lot. Thomas DiNapoli, the 54th controller of the state of New York, thank you for being with us on Just Love.
Listen, thanks, Kevin.
We're going to take a break now, and when we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We'll talk a little bit for a moment about Haiti, and then we'll talk about that situation in Colombia, which is such a dire situation. Just love. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself, and our world will be more just and more compassionate. Join us when we come back on the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is our weekly conversation about the church and the world. Just do it. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and more compassionate. You know, I wanted to take a little bit of time in our show this week to talk with Catholic Relief Services about what's going on in Haiti. You know, one of the things about Catholic Relief Services, whenever there is a disaster in so many countries of the world, they're your go-to organization because they're on the ground before a disaster hits and they're there after the news cameras has gone away. And, you know, other organizations sometimes do good work, but they're flash in the pans. Catholic Relief Services is there before, during, and after. I'm Kim Pozniak, is the Director of Communications for CRS. Kim, I know it must be very, very busy for you. I'm only going to take a few minutes of your time, but can you give our listeners a little bit of a sense of, from your people on the ground, what's going on in Haiti? How's the situation there?
Sure. I've been in touch with our teams in Haiti since Sunday, really, as they were starting to prepare for the hurricane that made landfall on Monday. And since then, there's been a lot of rain and heavy winds, and especially in the area of Lakai in the south of the country, there's been a lot of flooding reported already. Much of the rain and the flooding have taken out a bridge that really connects the capital of Port-au-Prince with that area. So access has been really difficult. And while we're in touch with our staff down there, enough to know that everyone's safe, updates and real information coming out of the area is slow at the moment.
Did people have a sense of has there been much displacement, people moving, homes destroyed? Do they have a sense of that?
It's hard to tell. It's too soon, and communications are still really difficult. But we did assist with getting people into evacuation centers and making sure they're up and running. But there's a lot of people that didn't want to leave their homes because they either didn't realize the severity of the storm or they wanted to stay behind and protect their homes and belongings. So it's still unclear just how many people have been displaced by this hurricane.
Isn't it so sad, whether it be in Haiti, the United States, so many parts of the world, that one of the things that people are worried about when there is a disaster, that that they might be safer physically if they leave their homes and possessions, but that other people then come and take advantage sometimes, and there's sometimes looting. That's one of the things that just makes me so angry and it makes me so sad, but it's understandable that people don't want to evacuate.
It is understandable that people want to protect their homes. And of course, you know, that could be a possibility, though it's really hard to know at this point. But also understand that it's an area where people are really poor and they become desperate if assistance doesn't get in right away. So, you know, you have to look at it with that in mind. But
now,
hopefully,
to give our listeners a sense, how does where this hurricane is hitting compared with where the earthquake hit? Oh, about 5 or 6 years ago.
The epicenter of that earthquake was around the capital of Port-au-Prince, which is north of Lakai, which is on the southern border of the country and seems to be the most affected area at this point.
Okay. So if our listeners want to continue to find out about what's going on there, how they might help, can you give them a way that they can do that, Kim?
Yes, you can find out more information on how to support our emergency response on our website at crs.org. And we'll continue to post updates, especially about our response. We'll be starting distributions, hopefully very soon, of drinking water, shelter supplies, food, and so forth, all the basic necessities that people will be needing in the coming days.
Hey, Kim Pozniak, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. I wanted our listeners to kind of be aware of the grave situation in Haiti. We don't know exactly how bad it is now, but even as importantly, to know that Catholic Relief Services, which is kind of the overseas arms of the church in the United States, is already on the ground. They're already responding, and they're ready to accept your donations to provide the help that needs to be helped. So, Kim Pozniak, thanks so much for being with us on Just Love.
Thank you for having me.
Tom, do we have one kind of short news item and then we'll take a break?
Sure, Monsignor, we do. You know, it's funny, you and Comptroller DiNapoli were talking before about kind of cynicism and spin. Well, Pope Francis has a prayer intention for October. You know, we always mention what his prayer intentions are. And this time, the prayer intention is for the work of the media and for reporters and journalists, that they be motivated by strong ethics and respect for truth. The Pope says in October prayer intention, we need information leading to a commitment to the common good for the humanity of the planet. Journalists in carrying out their work may always be motivated by respect for truth and a strong sense of ethics. So I think you and the Comptroller and the Holy Father seem to be on the same page, Monsignor.
We like praying together.
Yes, we do.
Okay, so let's take a break, and we'll come back, and we'll speak about the situation in Colombia, South America. Just love. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself. And our world will be more just and more compassionate. Excuse me. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. This is Just Love, the Catholic Channel, Sirius XM 129. Welcome back to Just Love. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Just love. Just love God. Just love your neighbor. Just love yourself, and our world will be more just and it will be more compassionate. We speak about what the church is doing in the world, and we speak about how we look at what's going on in the world through the prism of our Catholic beliefs and our Catholic values. We spoke earlier in the show with Thomas DiNapoli, who's the New York State Comptroller, and we spoke with Kim Posniak, who is with Catholic Relief Services, about Catholic Relief Services being already on the ground in Haiti. And realistically, Kim told us it's hard to get good information on the amount of damages, but if you want to kind of keep up to speed, go to that Catholic Relief Services website, and if you want to help and make a donation, you can find out how to do it there. So, but now I want to turn to another topic, which is not really terribly pleasant. You know, there's been this decade-long situation in Colombia in which the drug lords have had run really rampant in so many parts of the country. And just this past weekend, there was a vote to try to have a referendum on a peace plan. And the reality was that it got voted down very, very narrowly, but it did get voted down. So I thought it'd be good for our listeners to understand a little bit more about what's going on there, what has been going on there. And so I'm delighted that that assistant professor of history at Princeton University, Robert Call, has joined us. Professor Call, thank you for joining us on Just Love.
Monsignor, thank you very much for the invitation and the opportunity to speak about Colombia.
Great. So, in terms of full disclosure, I can speak a little bit of Spanish, and I learned it because I spent 6 weeks in Colombia in the 1970s at one of the universities there living with a family. So I have a particular personal interest in Colombia, and I really don't know much about its history and what's going on. So I'm delighted. Thanks for taking the time to be with us. So let me just assume for a moment that a lot of our listeners in the United States maybe were a little surprised that there was this referendum. I mean, I think probably many people understand, you know, they think of Colombia, a lot of drugs, drug trades, traffic, all of that. But tell us about this. I mean, a referendum with drug dealers? Give us a little bit of the history.
Sure. So one of the lines that we very often have seen in the U.S. media over the last few weeks since the announcement of the peace accord on August 24th, between the Colombian government and the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, Latin America's oldest and largest guerrilla group, one of the lines we've seen is that the struggle between the government and the FARC insurgents has been going on since 1964, so a 52-year struggle. This is a simplification. Colombia is considered, even by experts on Latin American politics, Latin American history, the region's most complicated country. Indeed, the FARC were founded in 1964, a group of peasants aligned with the Colombian Communist Party who had demands for land reform, sort of basic protections from the government that was sort of took up this Marxist, was wrapped in this Marxist rhetoric of class struggle, the popular seizure of power. They're actually a relatively marginal group in the country up until the 1980s. So I wouldn't be surprised if at the time that you were in Colombia in the early 1970s that people weren't talking about the FARC. They might have been talking about a couple of the other guerrilla movements that were in existence at the time, but the FARC aren't really part of the national conversation until the 1980s. And by the early 1980s, we see two things. One, we see the beginning of coca cultivation in rural areas of Colombia. So coca's it's a bush. The leaves are used as the raw material for cocaine. So we see a little bit of that, although coca cultivation is largely taking place in the 70s and 80s further to the south in countries like Peru. But what Colombia really becomes known for in the 80s, its sort of market specialization, is in the processing and trafficking of cocaine. So because of this, we have both the FARC are able to expand beyond their relatively limited original geographic base. And then also in response to that, you have the rise of drug cartels, very much on American minds now because of the show Narcos. Pablo Escobar from the city of Medellin, his rivals from the southwestern city of Cali. So from the 1980s, you really have the worsening of Colombia's conflict. So as the FARC are expanding, you see an alliance between drug lords, landowners, local politicians, and also elements of the army, the police, the state intelligence services, really ramping up violence, so causing massive numbers of internally displaced people within Colombia. So the violence is forcing people to flee their homes, particularly in rural areas. We also see some of the highest levels of homicide in any country, maybe not formally at war. So I think that's a piece of the story that's really worth emphasizing, is that a lot of the violence in the 1980s and 90s is committed on the part of these right-wing paramilitary groups. I think that's something that's really been lost in conversation, at least in the U.S. media over these last few weeks.
So let me see if I can sort it out, because I'm not sure I got it all. So you had, you know, a typical 1960s left-wing communist, typical themes of, you know, wanting more power, more land, et cetera, et cetera. You know, so, and then we go move to the 80s. So how does that movement get tied in with drugs?
Right. No, that's a great question. So the rural communists who formed the FARC lived really out on the margins of the country. So really very remote rural areas. These are very, very poor peasant farmers. That's the social base of this movement. You know, we see the image of Colombia as Juan Valdez, right? This one man growing coffee with his family, the man with his donkey. The FARC's base is in some way sort of a Juan Valdez figure, but by the 1970s, by the 1980s, they're growing coca because it is a steadier stream of income, steadier source of income than growing coffee or a traditional crop.
Right.
So the FARC initially aren't directly involved in the drug trade, but they are taxing drug traffickers who are moving through their regions. By the 1990s, though, after the fall of Pablo Escobar and his rivals, we do see both the right-wing paramilitaries and the FARC guerrillas moving more directly into the processing and shipment of the drug. So, yeah, it's a terribly complicated story.
So now let's go up to the past year or so. I mean, and again, I've talked on this show and kind of a little bit of a test to some guests to say, because nobody understands the fact that I don't know what the right number is, but it's certainly well over 5 million internally displaced persons in Colombia.
Yeah, it's really shocking. So we're talking about a country of roughly 40 million people. So we're talking one out of seven Colombians has had to flee fighting since 1985, which is considered by the Colombian government the beginning of the armed conflict.
So what was the deal that was cut that then got rejected?
Right. So beginning in the early 2000s, the Colombian government, with massive amounts of military aid from the United States, was able to begin inflicting a lot of damage on the FARC, which forced the FARC to the negotiating table. So these negotiations have been going on in Havana, Cuba, for nearly exactly 4 years. And it's really a remarkable array of international partners facilitating these talks. So we have hosted by the Cuban government, which is quite a change from the Cold War days when the FARC is founded in the 1960s. But we've also got the governments of Norway, Venezuela, and Chile acting as facilitators and so on. So after 4 long years, the government and the FARC reached a 297-page peace agreement. I mean, it's a remarkably lengthy document. And it addresses a number of concerns. And the FARC really have step back from the most radical of their demands for power and for a massive land reform. So what we see in the document instead are calls to expand or mechanisms to expand Colombia's democracy, to make it more pluralistic, to allow small parties that don't have representation in the media, in Congress, they're being able to get their message out. There's also a lot of discussion there very specifically about serving these rural areas that have historically been remote and neglected by the state, and then also really emphasizing the role of women in the process going forward and opening up political and social space for women to be equal citizens. We also see the longest portion of the agreement has to deals with not quite land reform to some extent. So again, not sort of radical redistribution along the Marxist lines that we might have seen the FARC call for since the 1960s, but very, very basic steps to ensure these poor peasant farmers who've been the FARC's base the possibility of a just livelihood. And then perhaps the most contentious piece of the 297-page accords has been the transitional justice mechanism. So how the FARC's commanders will, or FARC's members, excuse me, will accept responsibility for the violence that they've committed. The plan was if they admitted to their role in various kinds of not just violence but also drug trafficking, that they could receive relatively light prison sentences. This occurred too about a decade ago when the government demobilized the right-wing paramilitary force. There would be some harsher penalties for FARC commanders implicated in war crimes and so on, and that's really been the big sticking point. And that's what the opposition that won the referendum in its rejection on Sunday and the government are sitting down practically as we speak to talk about.
Now, so again, simplistically, again, if we think about general things, bad things go on in Colombia and it's all drug lords and stuff like that. That's certainly a narrative that's in the media. So how much now was the negotiation with people involved in the drug cartels? Were they part of FARC or is it different? Or does this get us some, does this get Colombia some peace with regard to the drug cartels too?
That's a really great question. And the corrosive influence of the drug trade over the last 35 years or so, 40 years, really can't be underestimated. So the drug cartels that we think of for the 1980s, so it's from Pablo Escobar and his class, they were very much opposed to the FARC and Colombia's other guerrillas. After they disappear from the scene in the 1990s, we see the FARC moving more into the drug trade, but at the same time, sort of the men who had been Pablo Escobar's lieutenants, really some of the most brutal figures in the last 35 years of Colombian history, they also moved increasingly into the drug trade. So, yes, to some extent, this peace accord with the FARC does touch on the issue of on drug trafficking, coca cultivation, and so on. But on the other hand, some commentators have pointed out that when we talk about this peace accord with the FARC, this is by no means the establishment of a definitive peace in Colombia. A minute ago, I referenced the demobilization of the right-wing paramilitaries in the mid-2000s. Not all of them demobilized, and some of them remain. They kept their guns, they kept their insignias. They're still out there running drugs, threatening peasants, and so on. So that was actually another piece of the accord, the government agreeing to take action against these sort of right-wing drug lords, or no, maybe not drug lords, but drug gangs, these smaller groups that have moved in to fill the void left by the Gran Capos, the big drug lords of the 1980s.
Men the next comment I'm going to make speaks more to me than to our listeners out there, but I think if I think this, there might be one or two people out there. So it'd be kind of naive for us to think that if this referendum had gone through or if it goes through again, that we've eliminated drugs in Colombia, that that's all gone and now we have, peaceful country there, that it's not quite that much of a silver bullet.
No, it's not. The drug problem is not going away anytime soon. That said, though, there are steps in the peace accords to allow for alternative crops. So allowing these poor peasant farmers who've traditionally been excluded from national life the possibility of a just livelihood that doesn't depend on the cocaine or other cocaine trade or other drugs.
Can I just ask you, we only have a couple more minutes, but I was intrigued by one thing you said, and can you give us like just the introductory minute or two lecture, not the whole course, on why Colombia is the most complicated country in South America? I may have overly simplified what you said, but you kind of said it was more complicated than a lot of other places. How so?
Yeah. I mean, that's one of the big questions that we historians of Colombia grapple with, particularly as we talk with our colleagues who study other countries. A lot of it goes back to geography, the fact that the Andes, just as they stretch from Ecuador into Colombia, break into three different ranges. So it's a remarkably diverse country. And you know, we've got jungle, we've got snow-capped volcanoes.
And two oceans.
And two oceans, exactly. The only South American country that borders on two oceans.
I didn't know that. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can go on Jeopardy now.
So that's that's not the entire explanation, right. but that's really a big piece of it.
And traditionally, it's not been one of the poorest of the countries of South America. It's had a relatively decent economy.
Yes. No, that is one of the central paradoxes as we look at Colombia in the 20th century. So there's no direct correlation between poverty and violence. Which is kind of remarkable. At the same time, you know, it's also Colombia has a prouder tradition of democratic governance than most other South American countries. So we don't see the kinds of military dictatorships that existed in other Latin American countries, say, when you were there in the early 1970s.
What's your estimate that the drug trade and the drug business there, what percentage of the GDP is that?
Oh, I'm not aware of any recent estimates. You know, obviously it's an impossible thing to quantify. I think the most reasonable estimates maybe say, you know, between 1% and 3% of national GDP, maybe a little bit higher than that. My favorite anecdote on this point, though, is in the 1980s, Pablo Escobar and his associates fled to Panama, and they told the Colombian government, look, if you pardon all of our crimes, we will agree to pay off Colombia's entire national debt, which stood in the, you know, tens of billions of dollars at that point.
Well, you know, it wouldn't surprise me if we got a comment like that out of our own presidential campaign this year. It's so crazy. But anyway, hey, Professor Gall, thanks so much. I learned a whole lot. Hey, and as this negotiation goes on, I hope we might call on you again to kind of help us to understand if they do reach a new agreement, what's going on there.
That would be my pleasure. I tell you, it's changing hour to hour at this point.
Oh, that's great. I mean, that's great that it's, I'm glad that it's not dead. So I'm glad about that. So anyway, Professor Robert Call, who is at Princeton University, he teaches history there. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you again.
Great. You know, we've had a good conversation today about public servant, and we had, you know, conversation about a little bit of hope in Colombia, even though it was not a good situation, but this agreement was voted down. But I have to say, I from my point of view, from what I read, it strikes me that this can be redone. I mean, some of it had to do with the fact that there was a huge storm and weather, and you know, millions of people didn't come out to vote. Mm-hmm. So when you have that, you know, that that difference, I don't think it's all dead. But you know, Tom, as we move into the election, we're going to talk a little bit more about some of the things going on. One of the things I want to talk more about is the document that the bishops of this country came out with, Faithful Citizenship. And there is a summary document that I think has a lot to do with, you know, summarizing issues and getting it there in a way that is people can understand. So we're going to talk a little bit more about that as we go into the future. And I think, you know, again, as Controller De Napoli said, in alluding to what the Pope said, it doesn't make some people happy when we say that, you know, the bishops, the Pope is not telling us how to vote. They're telling us to vote, and they're telling us to form our conscience properly. But they are saying you got to exercise some prudence in the way you analyze these things. And in the charged atmosphere in the country, and sometimes even in the church, what some people are saying is, well, you got to analyze it this way. If you're not analyzing it this way, you're not a Catholic. You're not doing it that way, you're not a Catholic. So we're going to help people to kind of think about that, hopefully properly form conscience. I'm Monsignor Kevin Sullivan. Thanks for being with us. Just Love, the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.
Listening to the Catholic Channel, SiriusXM 129.